Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by George Hotz. He's the co-founder and president of Comma.ai. They have an open source project called OpenPilot. They're selling the Comma 2 camera device, which basically enables your car to do lane keeping, adaptive cruise control. They're on the road, and they're claiming they're pushing for to be the Android of autonomous driving to Tesla's iOS. So I want to welcome George on the show. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Great. Today, I'm actually joined by Emmett Peppers as well. And we're going to go ahead and I'm going to be doing most of the questioning and Emmett will be joining in, sharing some of his, you know, ideas and questions throughout the interview. But first, George, I want to go ahead and congratulate you on Comma.ai. I know you guys have been racking up a lot of miles. Are you guys at like 50 million miles driven or what's the current stats on that?
We haven't done anything till we've solved self-driving cars.
Okay.
I mean it, right? Like a lot of people are like, oh, wow. Oh, I did so much. Oh, I'll pat myself. No, when we've solved it, we'll have a party. But until then.
Sure. I agree. I mean, one thing I noticed, you guys are shipping products. Like people are actually buying, you know, your Comma 2. They're sticking it in their car. Rumor has it that you're profitable. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely.
And what's going on? I mean, is it purely just the Comma 2 device sales that is, you know, covering your expenses?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've sold almost 6,000 of them.
Nice. Okay.
You know, $1,000 a piece. That's $6 million. Like, we've made more in revenue than we've raised. We're almost at 9 million revenue. We raised 8.1.
Nice. How many employees do you have?
20.
20. Okay. Yeah, because I've been tracking you guys since near the beginning. I know you guys started with a small team. A lot of these autonomous driving startups have, like, they hire hundreds and hundreds of people, you know, on their team. You purposely kind of just started with a super small team. What were you looking for in your, like, first few employees, and why did you keep so small?
But you see, they're targeting a different audience than we are, right? A lot of those companies are scams, and they're not targeting customers. They're targeting investment, right? So, you know, there's some old investors out there who think that if you have a large team, somehow you're succeeding. For me, I look at that, and that is in the red column, not the green column. But no, a lot of investors don't see it that way. And, you know, so that's why they grow. They hire these recruiters. They have a bar for talent that is so far below where Comma is. Like, you know, all these people, you know, like they interview at Comma. I'm like, I'll never hire this person, right? And then, oh, I got a job at Cruise. All right.
Got it. And you guys are based in San Diego, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fantastic. I noticed, like, you know, you founded the company, you led it as CEO, and back a couple years ago, for a few months, you left the company, and then you ended up coming back, I think, in May of 2019 as president. Kind of what happened there when you kind of left and you came back as president?
We got to become profitable. You know, I think that the emphasis on profitability was lost. So I showed back up and was like, yo, we got to, you know, start making money.
Got it. Do you ever disclose what percent of Comma.ai you own?
The majority.
Majority. Okay. Yeah, it makes sense.
And I'm the sole board member.
Okay. Really? Wow. That's pretty.
Yeah. I'm the sole board member. I own the majority. I've never sold a single share. I am not interested really at all in, you know, I have plenty of money to live my life, but I'm interested in making sure that the wrong sort of people don't gain any control.
Got it. You have ambitious plans. You're vocal saying you want to become the Android of autonomous driving to Tesla's iOS type of analogy. What is the master plan of Comma.ai? Like, how do you expect to actually get there?
Well, yeah. So our mission, and like it's nice to have a mission because, you know, it's easy to judge anything in the company about whether we should do it based on the mission. And the mission is the following statement: solve self-driving cars while delivering shippable intermediaries. So it says nothing about growth. It says nothing about, you know, any financial targets or anything. It's just solve self-driving cars. And even there's question of what that means. And what that means is make a superhuman driving agent. Make a piece of software that on average can do a better job than a human at the driving task. And then shippable intermediaries are, well, you know, people are like, oh, I'm going to sit in a room and solve self-driving cars for 5 years. Yeah, but what are you really doing, right? You know, prove it to the world. If you can't prove it to the world, you're not solving the problem.
Yeah. I mean, what's kind of confusing to me about the whole industry is typically, you know, with software, like you start with some type of minimum viable product or something that's a core feature, mm-hmm. and you build it incrementally, add more value, get more users. But it seems like the majority of these autonomous driving startups, they're doing this completely opposite approach where they're like building with hundreds of engineers, trying to magically create something that, you know, that we don't even know what they really have under the core. I mean, what's your take on kind of a lot of the industry here?
I mean, Theranos was exactly the same way, right? Theranos had a secret big reveal that was coming. It's a scam. I can say this with so much confidence now. I didn't understand it at first, but now having done this for 5 years, like, okay, we've shipped something. Tesla shipped something. GM has shipped Super Cruise, not to be confused with Cruise. They're completely separate. Super Cruise is something. You can look at it and see what it is. A bunch of the other companies are shipping things. Ford shipped Blue's Cruise, right? Like, if you can't buy it, it's not real. I can't believe there's never been a single startup in history that was like in stealth mode and then came out with something incredible. People get duped because Apple does this, right? Like Apple does this, but Apple has a track record for like 50 years.
Yeah,
when Apple has something in stealth, I trust that it might be cool. The Apple car might be cool. But you know, when Aurora is like, oh yes, oh, we have something great, oh yes.
Yeah, I mean,
anyone who's doing a SPAC also, like, it's an exit.
Yeah,
the SPAC. It's a straight up exit scam. You know, I know.
Have you been approached to do a SPAC ever?
Oh, of course.
Oh, sure.
Come on, man. I'm gonna cut you in, man. Come on, we're both in on the scam. Fuck off. We're here to sell self-driving cars.
So, let's go. Let's run with this scam narrative here. So, is this true or false that there are like bunch of startups are just taking like NVIDIA's Drive AX system, putting on some, you know, LiDAR or HD mapping thing, and then raising a bunch of money trying to, you know, claim that they're solving autonomous driving?
There was a great Onion article that said, self-driving car company raises $1 billion round. And, like, there's a quote from the CEO. They're like, at first we thought we might actually have to, you know, take a car and make it autonomous, maybe at least stick like a flashing light on it. But it turns out we didn't even have to do that. Right. Yeah, I can't. I don't know. I don't even like really want to like it was like funny to talk about a couple of years ago. No, it's just such a sad industry.
Okay, let's go back to real numbers, real shipping. How many daily active kind of users with comma.ai do you have here?
Our weeklies is 3,500. I just know that number because I put it in my presentation for Comic-Con. I think our dailies is like 2,500.
2,500. All right. So I'm going to put you on the spot a bit. October 2020 in your Lex Fridman interview, you said you guys were about 2,000 daily. If you're at 2,500, that's not a huge amount of growth. What's going on here?
Oh, we're at 2,000. Maybe it's like 3,000 dailies. The growth has been pretty consistent of, I don't know. Again, like, I don't care. Like, our mission is solve self-driving cars while delivering shippable intermediaries. I don't wake up every day and ask how much growth do we had. I wake up and ask, did the system get better?
I mean, okay, so what's this relationship to, you know, if you did have a lot more users, would that help, though, make your system better? No.
Well, the other thing, too, is, like, the way that we track, basically, users are a cost. Every user that uploads to us actually costs us money, more so than we actually get back. So no, more users would not help improve the system.
What's your limiting factor to improve the system?
Bugs.
And how do you, is it just purely human labor? Are you trying to squash the bugs? Like your programmers are doing that?
Yeah. So we have an automatic ground truthing stack. So we gather the data from the users, but you can't use the data like as is from the users. A stack which recovers, for example, the path the car went, right? Even an end-to-end system, you still need basically to like say, okay, go from image to path, and you have to recover the path. So that path recovery stack, well, it has some bugs, and these bugs aren't common. It works 99.9% of the time, but 0.1% of the time, say like the calibration is off by a degree. Well, then all that ground truth is wrong, and the model is being told wrong things. Then also we have you know, this logging infrastructure, which gets the stuff back. Turns out that in a couple percent of the route, the logging lags, right? You know, we put all the driving processes on these real-time cores, right? Because we don't want the driving to lag, and we shove the logger on the non-real-time cores, and then we started looking at the data, and we're like, oh, there's lag. It's this long tail of bugs in getting this stuff, getting, you know, multiple nines. 99.9 is not good enough. You need multiple nines because your model will just waste all its time trying to learn this bug data. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so how are you guys going to solve the billions and billions of corner cases that, you know, it's so hard to imagine even, you know, or even simulate the crazy stuff that's out there in this world without getting all of that corner case data from a bunch or millions of drivers on the road?
We have disengagements now about every, again, it's a hard thing to track, but like on the highway, maybe once every 200 miles now, right? So we're driving, like, I think it's 100,000 miles. It's either a week or a day. Again, I don't really know this stuff off the top of my head. But my point is we're getting plenty of disengagements. Like we're still orders of magnitude off. When we want to drill into the corner cases, we have this problem if, like, the entire day goes by and there's not a single disengagement to train on, right? Because then, okay, we're not getting the data of where we need to improve. But as long as you're still getting plenty of mistakes, like, we're in a realm of, yeah, we're in a realm of, for example, our lateral is now pretty much end to end, right? So our steering policy, if you turn the toggle on, doesn't use lanes anymore. So it's completely end to end from the user data. Our longitudinal is not, right? We don't do simple things like slow down for curves. Your car will go, we won't accelerate when we're in the curve, but we won't slow down in advance of the curve, right? You think, oh, this is really easy. You know the curvature of the road. Why don't you just slow down? Not true at all. The curvature of the road does not tell you how much you should slow down. For example, take the two exits. One exit takes you to another highway. One exit takes you to surface street. Every human knows for the second exit, you have to slow down more. And the only way to know this is context dependent. You can't do anything with the curvature of the path to tell you how much you should slow down. So we're working on an end-to-end solution there, but these end-to-end things take time, right? So it's not like if we got more data in, and this is a myth with Tesla too. Right, Tesla's limited by bugs as well. They're just not as, you know, forthcoming about that.
Okay, so I kind of wonder a bit with your whole end to end. So let's contrast it a little bit to Tesla's approach. Can you kind of explain kind of what Tesla's doing and how that's different than, let's say, your guys' end to end approach?
Mm-hmm. So Tesla has a human understandable semantic vision space. You've seen it. It's there. You can, like, if you've seen, like, Green the Only on Twitter, he posts those autopilot visualizers, and they, you know, it says, like, this is a car, this is a lane, this is, we don't do anything like that. We just say, given this picture, where should you drive the car, right? Where would a human drive the car in this scenario? Instead of saying, let's first detect the lanes and then let's have some hand-coded or, you know, even machine learning stuff to figure out where to drive. But we just ask the neural net, where should I drive?
How is that going to work when, for example, let's take the whole idea of perception or understanding, let's say, the world around and knowing how to navigate that world. How can you know how to drive unless you're able to understand that that thing is a plastic bag versus some type of crazy, you know, steel object that's going to, you know, kill your car? Like, how do you know how to navigate that environment unless you're able to accurately assess every single object in that world that you're perceiving there?
So what do you mean by accurately assess? Accurately assess and then print out, or assess somewhere deep inside the neural network and ask the question, what would a human do in this scenario, right? The human will plow through a plastic bag and they will stop for the steel. Even though it's not explicitly identifying it, it knows slow down or don't slow down.
Yeah, I guess the question though is the human can understand, and parse that object, what exactly the object is, in a millisecond time, then make the decision. And the corner cases are so vast in terms of the number of cases that haven't even appeared yet, right, in this world. And so you need that human judgment to say, quick, what is that and what to do? How can an end-to-end learning system do that unless you first solve the perception problem of identifying everything that a human can identify in the real world?
You're making an argument here for end-to-end, right? Like, one of the things we say at Comma is there's no human understandable layer between perception and planning. When a human sees a kangaroo jump out into the road, they instinctively slam on the brakes way faster than they can put a bounding box around the kangaroo or label each pixel as kangaroo pixels. Like, humans can do these tasks, but they're slow at it. Humans very instinctively can be like, whoa, right? Yeah.
So instead of labeling everything within the vision field, you're kind of like taking a big picture of the whole field and judging what to do with the whole picture versus trying to label every little thing in it and then deciding.
We put it in a neural net and ask the neural net the following question. Given this scenario, and it's not just a picture, we put a video in. Given this video, what would a human do next?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so even this whole deer example, right? I would push back a bit and say that, you know, the human sure stops, but in that millisecond time, they recognize that this could be a big object animal versus, let's say, a big plastic bag just, you know, goes right against the car. I'm saying there are these millisecond type of like, you know, things where humans are able to identify the object first before, right, planning. So I'm just saying that.
No, they don't. Humans don't. Humans, after the fact, may explain what happened, but they're actually using a different part of their brain to explain what happened versus the part of their brain that instinctively got them to slam on the brakes. You're making an argument for end-to-end here.
Well, okay, I guess what I'm saying, though, is ultimately, you know, I mean, the neural nets will probably do everything, right? They'll just give them the scene and the neural nets will figure out how to drive the best. Like, I understand that. And I understand the argument for end-to-end learning. I'm saying the process toward that goal, right? The intermediate steps. I'm saying, how can you get to the end-to-end goal of having the neural net do the entire stack, the entire process, without having the neural net's perception or vision system be so accurate that it actually is good or as better than a human's?
What do you mean by the neural net's vision system? What do you think the output of that vision system should be?
Well, I would argue that the bare minimum needs to be, if I'm able to scan a scenario and as a human, I'm able to identify how many, you know, humans, is that a human versus, you know, a different object, or is that a dog or something? And I can identify where the cars are, how fast they're moving, the approximate depth of everything. So all the objects and what they're doing.
When you're driving as a human, if there's 20 cars in the scene, are you working out the depth and the speed of each one of those 20 cars?
You know, I actually am. I'm actually, like, even in my peripheral vision, I'm kind of seeing, oh, there's a big fat car coming this way. I need to be careful.
Yeah.
I'm saying there's intuitive stuff. And whatever I'm able to focus on, I could clearly see, hey, there's 5 cars, there's 3 people, two dogs, and, you know, something dangerous, something not dangerous in that corner, right?
But humans don't do this. So, okay, for example, take a scenario of where there's lots of humans walking across at a crosswalk. Maybe there's, like, you know, 20 humans walking across. Humans don't know if it's 19 or 21. There's subitization. You can't subitize beyond 6. You can count, but it takes a long time. But humans understand, whoa, that's a lot of humans, versus these systems that are trying to individually segment each human. It's ridiculous. This is not how humans think at all. Humans just understand there's a lot of people there, I can't go, right? And that's fundamentally all you have to know. Inside the neural net, all this perception is taking place. I don't say that there's no layer between perception and planning. I say that there's no human understandable layer. And we can get into interesting scenarios. For example, when a human looks at a scene, humans don't just perceive objects, they also perceive the absence of objects, right? Humans will perceive when they're, you know, coming up to like a T intersection, if there's like a tree in the way, even though they don't see a car there, they think there might be a car there. And this stuff is very hard to encode in any sort of explicit layer, right? And this is why, like, we say this at Comma, there is no human understandable separation between perception and planning. There is, if you
George, want to- George, I sort of-
Yeah.
I do sort of agree with you on this principle. Do you think there's another reason Tesla and Elon are kind of going the extra mile trying to label every individual thing? Is it some real world AI application they want to apply later? Will it play a role in, or what are your thoughts on why Tesla's doing it, just to look fancy? Or
Elon is a modernist and I'm a postmodernist. As a modernist, Elon's core foundational science is physics. And he thinks of self-driving as a physics problem, right? And to be fair, a lot of Tesla is a physics problem. You think about when you're talking about, like, you know, joules of energy and supercharging and electric motors and torque and drag, right? These are all physics concepts. So they think of self-driving as a physics problem. And I've talked with some people at Tesla and they do think about it like this. Now, I personally think this is wrong, but this is the kind of thing where, like, would I bet on us or would I bet on Tesla? I've moved a little bit more toward us now that I've experienced FSD, but, like, I don't really know. I'm not going to call Tesla a scam the same way I call Aurora a scam, right? Like, I think that if I was a betting man, I'd still bet on them to beat us. But our foundational science, like, I'm a postmodernist. I think in terms of information theory. I think in terms of a system, you have inputs, compute, and outputs. And, like, that's how I treat the whole thing. So I think that's why Tesla takes that approach and why we take this approach.
Yeah, I think the thing that, I guess the issue or the question mark I have is this whole thing of, it seems like, you know, if you take this, you know, identifying every single object, and, like, I'm not sure if you've seen the latest kind of bird's eye view where Tesla's doing camera fusion of all the cameras into, you know, single view. And then they're doing kind of a pseudo LiDAR kind of approach where they're actually identifying the object depth and velocity of all the objects in that view, right? And on top of that, they're, you know, trying to understand every single object, right? And what
very physics-y, right?
Exactly. But what I'm saying is that I don't know if that's really mutually exclusive to an end-to-end learning approach or system.
Meaning
you can do that and you can do end-to-end learning. So if I was to say, like, hey, like, why not do both then? Why not actually go head on and figure out everything, but also do end-to-end learning? And it seems to me like, isn't that kind of what Tesla's doing? They're just doing the first one first. They're doing this, you know, what they call vision first, but they're going to get to end-to-end. They're going to do, neural nets will run the whole shabam, you know, like, sooner or later. Yeah.
And this kind of stuff that Tesla is building, it's not going to hurt them. It may be not a perfectly efficient, capital deployment, right? Like,
mind, it's not necessary, basically, right?
It's not necessary. And, like, it depends. Yes. If you have a whole other, look, if Comma had a whole different division that required no resources to manage, and I told them to take that approach, of course I'd do it, right? But yeah.
Well, I mean, that's my a question, I guess, is ultimately, isn't the results the determining factor? Whose car drives the best, right? In most situations,
absolutely.
Right? So, I mean, in your case with Comma focusing on end to end, shouldn't you kind of take some hints in terms of, like, hey, if Tesla's doing, let's say, this vision approach first as a foundation, and maybe planning end to end a bit later, shouldn't we borrow some of that to, you know, I don't know. Or do you feel like do you feel like you're fine? You're going to somehow, you know, improve even faster than Tesla's.
We also have different goals, right? Us and Tesla have different goals, right? We don't say anything like full self-driving. Comet is proud level 2. Our slogan is make driving chill. Tesla's slogan is maybe look at this crazy feature, right? And I mean it. And, like, I'm not knocking on that. I'm not saying that like one of these things is right. It kind of does appeal to a different audience. So, for example, Tesla wants to ship something like, watch, it stops at a light and then makes a right turn, right? I care more about, like, very precise positioning on the highway. For example, when you have an exit lane, you have two lanes here. The Tesla will move over a little and then move back. I don't like that, right? I want it to feel like the placement is human. And I've tried autopilot. I've driven thousands of miles with autopilot. And there's things autopilot does better and there's things autopilot does worse. They're pushing more on these kind of featurey things. And we're pushing more on this kind of, like, you take autopilot off an off-ramp and I'm like, their placement is not human. This is not where a human would place the car.
Sure. I mean, I would argue that that's a minor issue that, if you look at the trajectory 2 or 3 years ago and see where it's at today, autopilot on the highway for Tesla's improved dramatically. I mean, it's like almost almost night and day. I'm saying like that's minor. Tesla can improve the actual planning feature, right? Make it more human, like do more reinforcement learning over time, neural nets, etc., rather than heuristics. But I mean, city driving. Okay, let's talk about city driving. Like when is Comet AI going to be able to do, you know, some city driving, like turning left and right and all that?
So turning left and right, I have very little interest in. I've been in cars that turn left and right. I've been in the FSD Beta 8, and I've been in our demos where we had similar stuff in 2017. It's uncomfortable. You've been in an FSD car.
Actually, I have the beta on my car right now.
You have the beta on your car. Okay. So I'm not talking about if it makes a full stop and then makes a turn, it's fine. But have you had it made any turns and not make a full stop?
Yes. Occasionally. Actually, this beta is a lot better. I heard the previous beta there, it wasn't stopping all the time.
No, but I'm not even talking about even a car that does it perfectly, right? Even a car that perfectly, it is uncomfortable to be sitting in the driver's seat while your car is making a 90-degree turn, right? Like, eventually these things are going to be superhuman and then you're just going to trust it, but if it's like kind of unperfect and you're watching the wheel go like this, I'm like, right? And that's like, again, Tesla's slogan is look at this crazy feature. Our slogan is make driving chill. We don't really think that's that chill. So I'm not interested in left and right turns. I am interested in stoplights and stop signs, but we can get that.
Sure, but how do you even think that you're going to reach autonomous driving in the same vicinity of time of Tesla if you're not pushing the envelope with making left and right turns, even, you know, trying right now and focusing on it when Tesla is like, you know, pushing ahead with these crazy features?
So you can think about the difference between like Stockfish and AlphaZero. You know, they're both chess engines, right? You look at Stockfish and the way Stockfish improves, and you know, they have some, they don't entirely ignore like machine learning and testing, but it's still very much based on like, oh, well, here's our reward function for how much a pawn in the center of the board is worth. Here's our reward function for like, you know, having two rooks on the back rank, like that kind of stuff, right? So Tesla does something very similar with their planner. They're hand tweaking weights in the planner, and so does Stockfish. AlphaZero does not, right? So AlphaZero, and I've tried to write things that look like AlphaZero. When you write them, at first they're so bad at chess, right? Like even the most naive 3-move-ahead searcher, like you write it in like Python, it's like really stupid, and you just use like, you know, the basic like queens are 9, rooks are 5 kind of thing. And you're gonna beat the neural chess almost all the time. But once you fix all the bugs and once you get that neural chess to work, it's just a question of like it just starts to work really, really well. And now AlphaZero has surpassed Stockfish.
Okay. I mean, to me, that's like pretty obvious there in a sense where, you know, you have with chess or let's say Go or whatever, or a game, you have pretty much a closed system, meaning the possibilities aren't infinite in terms of what's going to happen.
They're effectively infinite. The possibilities in chess
there are rules, right? But in real life, real world driving, the rules are actually sometimes completely thrown out of the window in situations that are so just crazy and oftentimes life-threatening and dangerous.
Okay, so let's talk about...
I guess, the point being, in a world of infinite kind of, you know, changing rules, I would understand, like, if it's a more defined system of rules that you go 100% neural nets, you know, end-to-end learning, et cetera, planning. But in a world that's untamed, like, it would seem to me that Tesla's vision approach is more, let's tame this crazy world, you know, with vision and labeling and fix this. And then we can start the alpha, you know, zero, whatever.
I don't think that's the right approach. So first off, to get to this question, let's first off be very careful with the word infinite. So the amount of possibilities in the world versus possibilities in Go are similar, right? Like it's not possibilities, it's not states, right? There's more states in Go than there are atoms in the universe. You can argue that Go actually has a more complex state space than driving. And I think there's a good argument for that. But I very much agree with you that the rules of Go have very small comma graph complexity. If you're talking about the rules of Go, I can write the rules of Go down on a sheet of paper. You want to write the rules of the world down on a sheet of paper? Anyone who's trying to do that. By the way, anyone who's trying to learn from simulation and not, this is another thing where, you know, Tesla and us agree, and I think it's absolutely critical, and I don't know how anyone is thinking anything else. You need big data. If you want to understand the rules of the world, you need lots of data from the world. Now, not, I think R scale is enough. For example, we have 10 million miles sitting on servers. That's 20 years of driving, right? Humans learn to drive in 20 years, obviously, right? 20-year-olds can drive cars. But you can't do it from, like, you know, your 5 test cars. This is a terrible idea, and it's never going to work. So you need lots of data on the real world to learn the rules. But the real world does have rules. They just don't fit on a sheet of paper. They're very complex. But nobody would expect, you know, if there's like a cone and a car is headed toward the cone, nobody expects some like Kitty Pryde phasing and the car is going to go through the cone. No, it's going to hit it, right? There are very clear rules for the world and they're never violated. We call these rules physics, right? So you can learn the rules of the world. Actually, some of the hardest rules of the world to learn are not about cars and cones, but are about other drivers because you have a full human intelligence there, right? But another reason simulation is doomed to fail. But so just because the rules are more complex, this idea of trying to say, okay, first we're going to do a perception layer on top of this, it won't work because your perception layer will never be complete. You will always be missing some stuff. And you can give me any, sometime I'll do this experiment with people in interviews and like ask them to give me a complete perception of the world, and then I'll give them a case where it obviously violates it. Right. A lot of time people forget about the occlusion one. A lot of time people forget about like, oh, there's a tree. Well, is the tree blocking the road or is it blocking nothing? Right.
Sure. I mean, okay, I agree that perception layer obviously will be incomplete. Humans, you know, have mm-hmm. incomplete perception. But if you start with the foundation of, hey, we're going to have a, you know, computer vision system, neural nets, you to perceive the world in an equal or better fashion, more accurate fashion than a human being, using that as a foundation to build. Right, why doesn't that make sense?
Okay, so we have this project called Comma 10K. It's open source. We've asked people to hand label, and we only have 5 categories. It's much simpler than Tesla's. We use some segments. We use some segments in our automatic ground truthing project. Segments, semantic segmentation, label each pixel with what it is semantically, right? So we have 5 categories, road, lane, movable, my car. Actually, maybe it's just 4. I think we got rid of sky, because who needs a sky? It doesn't matter, right? What's the difference? Oh, yeah, undrivable. No, there are 5. Undrivable, road, lane, movable, and my car, right? Only lanes and undrivable are semantic there. Movable and my car are not semantic because you can learn them unsupervised because movable objects don't move with ego motion of the car and my car is always stationary, right? So those ones are pretty easy. But you get to really hard questions like, what's a lane? Okay, what if you have a tar mark? Is that a lane? Well, if it's in the middle of the road, no, but if it's next to the lane lines, maybe it is, right? Like it's really hard for humans to answer the question whether this is a lane or not. You can get some pictures where 50% will say one thing and 50% will say the other, right? So like there is no clear perception there. Now you can pass, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, let's say if you're doing a perception first type of approach, you could say, hey, this situation is I'm unclear, or you know, our system's unclear. We pass it off to, you know, our planning engine or neural net system to make the right decision in that situation. I mean, wouldn't that be an option?
Well, yeah, but at that point then, if you're gonna pass all the hard scenarios off to the neural net, trust me, it can do the easy ones too.
I mean, right. Well, the thing is, I guess the question mark being is how many of these actual corner cases do we need to feed into the system? Is that beneficial? Because your angle, it seems like, well, we don't need all these corner cases, but Tesla's like, this is ultimately important.
We absolutely do. In order to get to level 5, we absolutely need all the corner cases. I do not believe our current data is sufficient to get to level 5.
How do you get all the corner cases in your approach then?
The exact same way that Tesla does. We'll have a huge fleet of cars and every disengagement is a corner case, right? Every time a human overrides what the car does, we're level 2 forever. Wait a second, we did something wrong. Okay, let's backprop the error through, right? So it's the same basic idea, but we have enough data now. We have more than enough data now because we're still getting in thousands of mistakes a day.
Yeah, okay, so I mean, the difference though would be, for example, you bring in, let's say you have millions of cars on the road eventually, you bring in all the corner cases. rather than labeling everything in every situation, you would just say, here's what the car should have done, you know?
Exactly. And how do I know what the car should have done? It's what the human did, right?
Yeah, or what the human wanted to do, I guess, or would have done.
Well, that's even better.
Yeah, right. And then you feed into the neural nets to get to improve the system, basically, right?
Yeah, there's really cool ways to do that. So we actually do all this. We use a, so it's a simulator, but it's not like a Unreal a world simulator. It actually uses the real data from the drive, right? So say the car, like, you know, takes an exit. You don't want it to take an exit, right? So the car starts to take the exit. The human grabs the wheel. They turn it a little back left, and they go this way, right? So what we do is we back project in the simulator, and we say, okay, obviously, the human did not want the path to be moved toward the exit and swerve back. Obviously, the human wanted to stay on this trajectory the whole time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it seems like, you know, in my opinion, that's probably eventually also what Tesla will end up doing.
It is.
Probably, meaning in terms of even the corner cases, they just feed it in, like, the optimal path. I mean, it just seems like maybe it's, I don't want to say semantics, but different approaches. Ultimately, the data, is going to, feed the system.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I mean, where do you see this headed? Do you think there is going to be one or two kind of big players like a iOS or Android versus, let's say, it's going to be commoditized to the point, let's say autonomous driving, to the point where you have 10 or 20 different solutions from a bunch of companies that are on par? Or do you think there's just inherently a couple that will stand out?
I think there's three. I think there's, so the iOS and Android is an analogy I like, but I think maybe even a better analogy is Tesla is the Mac, right? So this is again iPhone, but it's the Mac, like the laptop. We're the Linux, right? We're open source, used by a lot of like different sort of people. And then Mobileye is the Windows, right? Mobileye, they have a similar business model to Microsoft. They're licensing you their operating system for a fixed cost. They make deals with manufacturers. Microsoft makes a deal with Dell. Mobileye makes a deal with Mercedes, right? So I see those three players. And they're the only ones today with data gathering networks of any real size.
Mm-hmm. Going forward. Right?
Well, actually, I'll refine that a little bit. Those are the only three companies that make money the more cars they add to their network, right? So Tesla sells a car, they make money. We sell a device, we make money. Mobileye sells a chip, they make money, right? Waymo adds a car, oh, they lose more money. Oh, so that's the difference.
Super Cruise?
Super Cruise does not have a sophisticated data gathering apparatus, right? I'm talking about people who can get videos back.
Okay.
Do you think all these other companies transition to vision only?
A lot of them are now, but largely because of part shortages. Right, Honda's the 2022 Civic is vision only. Tesla's vision only is I watched Kropacki's presentation on that, and I'm like, this is what we were doing 2 years ago. So there are places where we're ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've been doing it longer. That's right.
Well, okay. What do you mean by 2 years ago you're doing what they're doing? I'm curious.
So they're doing now basically ground truthing. Not of the pixels of the car, but of the like lead car as an object with like the velocity and the distance, right? They have vision only, and vision only breaks for overpasses. And you're like, this is weird. Why would vision only break for overpasses? This is clearly just a radar bug. And it's because the radar bug has leaked through their ground truth into their final system, right? And they'll clean up these bugs, right? Like we did it 2 years ago. It's not like, it took us 2 years to clean up the bug. So, I think we're going to launch vision only this year. And I think our vision only longitudinal is going to be better than Tesla's.
Sure. I mean, okay, but let's I would say the other side, we'll give credit to where some credits do. You're not fusing eight different cameras together, to create a 360 view of what's around the car.
Oh, yeah, but okay. So Tesla does a much better job at spatial awareness than we do. One of the things that I was particularly impressed by with Autopilot was when it made an automatic lane change, it slowed the car down to fit in a gap. And I was like, all right, we'll get there, but we're not there yet, right? That's something Tesla's had for a bit. I was impressed by that.
I want to ask about this whole thing of, do you think with autonomous driving, is the data going to be... the question is, where does it asymptote? Where, I mean, is it still going to be valuable in the future, and will it provide enough network effects to allow for, you know, a winner takes most type of, you know, impact? Or do you think data, even at the corner cases, will be just like, will lose its value because it reaches a certain level of safety that's good enough? Like, what's your take?
The value is not in the data. The value is in the processing. The value is in, what's Tesla's name for it? Data engine?
Dojo.
Dojo is their big new trainer that doesn't exist yet. But they have this thing called data engine where they can like refine and label stuff for cheaper than other people, right? We have automatic ground truthing, right? I think the real value is in these engines. It's not in the raw data. It's in how well can you process. And like, there's a Robin Hanson tweet that I like. It's like, most companies don't want fancy machine learning. They want linear regression on cleaned up data. How well can you clean up the data? How well can you filter out all the bugs from your data? The pieces of software that are capable of doing that is where the value is. Data is just a question of cost.
Okay, got it. Let's go into this whole data engine thing. Have you checked out kind of Tesla's latest auto labeling approach, where they will, for example, take a 10-second video clip of a scene, you know, identify objects, but then basically go back propagate that object throughout all the frames to increase the accuracy of all of the objects in these videos?
This is exactly what I talk about that we were doing 2 years ago. When I talk about automatic ground truthing, that's auto labeling. It's the same thing. We've been doing this since like really the beginning of Comma. Like, yeah, we you know, one of the beauties of figuring out which your lead car is you can look at the future path and you can figure out what car the future path intersects with, right? And Carpathy talks about the same thing again. You know, it's automatic ground truth. It's a good idea.
Hey George, one question for you is, do you have any kind of like, I know in the past you've dealt with Elon directly on certain things, but do you have any kind of like open line of communication with Andre or Elon? I mean, I think that could be helpful for both of you guys to share ideas. You have different customers. You could probably advance your stuff faster both sides.
We've talked a few times. I mean, it's unclear like exactly what would be shared, right? I mean, I would love for Tesla to say, we're going to start contributing to OpenPilot, but I don't really see that happening anytime soon, right? It's, you know, Mac is not even based on Linux kernel, it's based on Mach, and like, so.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you clearly have very genuine ideas that are very, you know, a clear thinking in a certain way. I bet you could certainly help Tesla in some of their approaches too, I would think. I mean, could be a good way to exchange ideas, I'm thinking.
Again, you know what? The real bet is going to be on, like, we're just going to see whose system's better in a few years, right? With what I've seen with the directions Tesla's going with FSD, I don't think this is the right direction. And I think that we have a little bit more. If I was betting, I'd still bet on Tesla to get to level 5 first. But I think it's narrowed a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, pound for pound, there's definitely a difference. I mean, they have massive resources on this. You have 20 people, pound for pound. You guys are pretty incredible what you're doing, I'd say. So I think there's a lot of benefit if you guys are sharing ideas. But
I think that matters at all. I mean, we are sharing ideas. It's right. Like Tesla's very open about what we're doing. We're very open about what we're doing. Sure. I watch their presentations. You know, they watch ours. Like, that's just how it works.
But like the type of discussion you're having with us, if you had it with like Andre directly, it could probably...
Yeah. Look, I've hung out with Andre. We've had these kind of conversations.
Good.
Good. Okay. So I'm curious. When did you test out FSD 8 version, beta 8?
About a month ago.
Oh, really? Okay. All right. And you said you weren't impressed, or were like, what was your take on that?
I found it stressful.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
I found it very stressful to use. It felt robotic. And of course it does, because it's not an end-to-end planner. It's a planner with all these hand-tuned costs. And like, while it may be able to drive from point A to point B without disengagements, it's not driving using the human policy. And I don't think that's a good idea long-term.
Got it. Yeah. Definitely. Would you say that the writing or driving in FSD beta version 8, did you get the sense that Tesla's ambitious? At least they're pushing things forward.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They're definitely. Well, I mean, this is something that I have a ton of respect for Tesla on. It's like, first off, Tesla, thank you for doing this. It makes it makes what we're doing look much more, you know, sane and reasonable. So it's really nice to have them kind of pushing the way. I always like to say, like, you know, don't be a leader, be a follower. Right? There's a cost to being a leader. It's easier to be a follower. So, you know, I'm very happy to exist and I'm happy that they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah, definitely. How does comma.ai add the necessary extra cameras to eventually go, you know, full self-driving, like in every situation? You know, right now you have one camera, you know, the front. Eventually you'll need side or back cameras, maybe additional front camera. Like, it seems like it would be a challenge for a DIYer to, you know, install all these multiple extra cameras throughout the car. Have you thought about, like, the next step? Does this require a partnership with the OEM? Like, what are your thoughts?
Definitely not. You know, we have a big event coming up on Saturday.
Yes, Comic-Con in San Diego.
Comic-Con in San Diego, yeah. We'll fix that there. You'll see what we have to announce. No, it doesn't require partnerships with OEMs. Look, I mean,
hey, wait, are you streaming that event at all, or are you recording it?
Yeah, it'll be streamed.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah, we'll stream. Some of the stuff won't be, but the main talks will be streamed. The cool announcement will be streamed.
What part of the day? I was looking at the schedule. I mean, afternoonish or during your talk?
My keynote's at like I think at 1:00. Yeah, it's you know, people always get us with the multiple camera thing, and I'm like, you understand that this is not that hard, right? Like, it's not that difficult to ship a device that has more cameras in it. Building the software is the whole hard part.
Okay, got it.
Right? Any 2-bit phone manufacturer can build a little plastic box with a bunch of cameras in it, right?
This is pretty cool. So wait, Comma 2 shipped, was it January of 2020 or so? Okay, so it's been a good year and a half, kind of ready for an upgrade here, huh? Cross multi-camera, Comma 3, leaked here. But no, I'm excited. Yeah, I definitely want it.
When is this coming out?
Probably in a day or so, yeah. Or do you want me to wait?
Just watch the Comic-Con presentation.
No, I mean, sure, nothing revealing here.
I will say this, prices are going to go up. You know, a cell phone in a plastic case is $1,000, but fancy multi-camera automotive grade HDR custom injection molded, you know, it's gonna cost more money.
I can see the excitement. This is gonna be pretty cool.
Oh, it's really good. It's really good. And then this should finally put all the but they only have one camera people to, you know.
Awesome.
Maybe you really do like manufacturing more than software. Sounds like you're excited about this new device.
I mean, I'll say this. I've been driving with one for the last 6 months. They're good. You just put it next to a Comma 2 and you're like, oh, well.
Superior.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, in the past you've said that, you know, you're not really interested in being acquired, especially from like a laggard type of OEM like Ford or Toyota, etc. Hyundai, you said you might be open to, or a tech company like Apple. But yeah, what would be the ideal partnership for you guys if something panned out? Or is it just like, just more weight, you know,
it's just
slow you down.
Before the Comma 2 launch, I was, you know, before we were profitable, I was more open to an acquisition. Not anymore. We're a profitable company. Here's a fun fact. The gross margin in automotive is 18%. Right. The gross margin in consumer electronics is 58%. Why do I want to be in automotive? Right, we're a consumer electronics company. Like, what we eventually imagine is that other companies are going to make OpenPilot devices in the same way other companies make Android devices. But again, none of this requires an explicit partnership. Like, we can have the same kind of deal as like Google with Android. If you want to like use the OpenPilot trademark, then you know, it's some money to us per device, and you know, you can use our servers and our back end, and that kind of stuff.
Got it. Let's talk business model here for a second. I've heard a couple, I would say conflicting, but different business model approaches from you in previous interviews. So one approach is, okay, sell a device. Let's say in the future, this continues to go up. Let's say, you know, 2000 or even more. Yeah. Sell a million a year. That's $2 billion in revenue.
Yeah.
Like 60% gross margin or more, right?
Yeah,
you're talking about
money.
Like some, yeah, you're talking about some mega multiple, right? Off of that, you know, those numbers right there. That's impressive.
That's exactly the business model.
Okay. On another interview, you're talking about car insurance. You know, have you adapted your thoughts on that?
I just like woke up one day and thought about it and realized it was boring. So we're never going to do it. No, we sell little box for more than it costs us to make. And then we sell lots of little box to lots of people. You know, there's 25 million cars in America alone that OpenPilot supports. Mm-hmm. There's 25 million cars on the road that could use OpenPilot today, right? Now, in just the US, yeah. So we have a huge addressable market.
That's only growing every year. Right.
Oh, it grows every year. Absolutely. And then it's not like, you know, people get a new car, you know, maybe every like 5 years or something. This is a cell phone. People get a new cell phone every two. Right.
Yeah.
You can upgrade the autonomy system in your car separate from the car itself.
Got it.
So, yeah, we have, you know, huge potential, way more than, you know, I joke. It's like, you know, Ford's not going to buy us. We're going to buy Ford. If we ever want a car company, I'll buy one. Right?
Okay.
Like I'm not gonna get acquired by some too big car company.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, I was gonna ask you that. Would you be ever interested in buying an OEM? And you're saying maybe. You know, it depends.
I'm a simple guy. You know, it sounds like a lot of complexity. As much as I'd love to like go in there and like, you know, tear things up and like just tear through this organization, fire 60% of the people. You know, I would love it. And like, you know. But
exactly. So in order to stick a comma, you know, device, let's say the two or the three, onto mm-hmm. your car, is it pretty much the requirement you need kind of mobilize type of, you know, equipment there with their vision or radar system, like, and to control the steering and the.
No. So we are still using the radar from the car, but that requirement's going to go away in a few months. So it will be entirely based on the cameras from the device. But we do need the brake controller and the steering controller to accept braking and steering commands. Because enough of these cars are shipping with these like low quality features that do that now, it's much easier for us to just use the same API.
Okay.
Right?
Who's making this equipment to go into these OEMs? Who are the major players?
So like steering racks are made by a lot of Bosch. Some NIDEC is the Honda one. Toyota has their own custom one. I think it's the company's called Denso. Those are steering racks. Brakes are, again, a lot of Bosch. Radars are Bosch and Delphi, right? So you could just, you know, use what's already in the car.
Got it. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, would you say eventually, like in a few years, like all cars will have, you know, brake and steering wheel controls that you can tap into?
Yeah, I think NCAT, I think they're mandating AEB in 2022. And then it's cheap enough. So like if you go back to the Tesla, the pre-AP1 Tesla, it had AEB, but it didn't have a brake rated for continuous duty. So they had this thing called the iBooster, but now it's like cheap enough now that they're just putting these interfaces in the car. Almost every car after 2016 has electronic power steering. So it's just a software question if there's a command to actually put some torque on the steering wheel. They do electronic power steering because it's more fuel efficient. You don't have to run the hydraulic pump constantly. You know, when you're on the highway, you don't really need power steering.
Business opportunity for folks who are listening here. It seems like, so you have OpenPilot, which is an open mm-hmm. source project. You guys are making a big bet on being basically a consumer products company selling these devices. So you're open to others making different devices, kind of like the Android
Absolutely.
Ecosystem, right?
Absolutely.
Samsung and, you know, Huawei and Google has their Pixel. Are you basically creating your Pixel as, you know, like Google? Like
exactly. So, I mean, we have the exact same advantage Google does on the Pixel, right? We know the software roadmap, even though we're open with it, like we know it and we're intimately familiar with it. We can put a lot of time into making sure the software works really well in our devices. Other manufacturers could do that too, but they don't know the software as well. What I see happening, the place where I really see people coming in is on the low end. And you see this with Android too. It's going to be hard to compete with us on the high end because we can offer, you know, these crazy things, but it's expensive, right? I could see someone coming in and, you know, accepting smaller margins and making, you know, low-end OpenPilot devices in the exact same way people make low-end Android devices. I'll give them a shout out. There's a Kickstarter doing it now. I forget the name of it, but they're using like a rock chip processor. It's going to be kind of hard to do the port, and the experience is not going to be great. But you know, it's 5x less expensive, right? So I think that appeals to a certain group of people, and I see that everyone who they appeal to is kind of an on ramp for, you know, buying the high end device, right? It gets you into the OpenPilot ecosystem. So we are very excited for when people come in and build devices, because we don't see them as competing with us. We see them as expanding the pie of this device, right? Like, it's okay, they might take some of our customers, but, you know, really they're going to help expand this to a huge wide audience in a way that we don't really want to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely makes sense. I mean, the business model, when I hear it from you or thinking about it, I'm like, it's honestly ingenious, but it's pretty solid there, you know. I mean, you have the revenue, the margins, the total addressable market is, you know, just huge, right? You have 80 million cars per year. Everything's moving to this. You guys are focused on the software, you know. It's open source. You're getting the best, you know, contributors, mm-hmm. hashing out the bugs. Definitely impressive stuff.
One of the best things about open source is we support 130 cars now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't own 130 cars. That's all user contributed. We have 5 cars, right? We'd never be able to get that kind of compatibility. And then you have these people who like really care about making their car good.
Yeah, definitely. Do you have any plans on expanding from cars to like RVs? Like, for example, I have a 2020 Mercedes Sprinter based RV that mm-hmm. I think has the necessary equipment, but you guys don't seem to support it, or even big rigs like diesel trucks. Like, you know, having an OpenPilot where you're able to like just stay in the lane and relax a little bit more on 10-hour trips, like for truck drivers, that would be, you know, pretty beneficial, like much well worth its weight, you know, or its cost. Well, right,
so not all trucks are the same. How many Mercedes Sprinters are sold a year?
Actually, I think it's quite a bit, isn't it? Like 6 digits. I think it's like,
I don't think it's 6 digits.
Really? I think it's pretty.
How many Honda Civics are sold a year?
A few million, right?
Yeah, a lot more, right? And that's like, this long tail is not that important. It's really just important that we support the top cars. Especially when cars get weirder, like Civics, Corollas, Accords. This is the bread and butter. Support the cars everyone has.
Got it. LiDAR. So is LiDAR a trap? Like, why are so many people like so, you know, gung-ho bullish about LiDAR, saying you need LiDAR? Where is this all headed?
So a lot of people get this idea they're going to copy Google, right? So Google used LiDAR on their Waymo cars, right? Like LiDAR was like a weird technology, but it happened to win the DARPA Grand Challenge driving across the desert. It was Veldine 64. These people are all copying Waymo. The thing is, the company that you're copying is a huge money sink. So I don't get it. Right? Like this, like these people also aren't really using LiDAR that much for detection. They're using it for localization. So they're using precise localization and HD maps. This approach is absolutely ridiculous. It's not at all how humans drive. To say a lot about how Tesla's approach is different, but at least they're not doing this crap, right? Like, oh, we're gonna map every segment down to a centimeter, and then like some guy moves a lane line, and then it's like, oh, it's gonna plow right into a wall, right? Like, it's a bad idea. You have to put the intelligence on the car, not on the cloud.
Where is this headed? Do you think are they just gonna be like, for example, Waymo? Are they just gonna be stuck in their geofenced, you know, mapped out areas like city centers for it to be, you know, more the role of a taxi? Do you think there's a business model for that?
I heard a good, yeah. I heard a good joke about Waymo, and it's, you know, when Waymo One launched, their service area was 100 square miles, right? 2 years later, it was 50 square miles. So we got like an inverse Moore's Law thing going on here. In 20 years, the service area won't even be able to fit a single Waymo in it. they'll shut it down. They'll shut it down.
Shut it down, you think? Yeah. And I mean, do you think they'll pivot into some type of vision only, or will it be just?
I don't think they can. I think they're too bloated. I think they've already burned way too much money, right? There's no reason to pivot, right? You want to pivot. If you're an organization that's like profitable, but you're starting to see profits decline, okay, pivoting might make sense. If you're an organization that's effectively billions of dollars in debt, don't pivot. Shut the organization down and start a new one, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It always like struck me, like if Google had, I want to say some sense with autonomous driving, but let's say some common sense with autonomous driving, that they would somehow leverage their Android, you know, ecosystem, like devices to, you know, pay people to, you know, get data to start kind of similar.
It's not useful. We did this. We had an app called Shiffer, which you could download from your phone. It would upload the data to us. We thought we were going to use it. We never did. It's too hard to use. It's too unstructured.
Got it. How are you guys structuring it differently? Is it more the interventions that matter the most, that give you guys some type of like signal amongst the noise?
No, every single one of our devices is identical. Right? Every Comma 2 is identical and has the identical suite of sensors and is running logging software that's like tied into the kernel to run in real time, right? Versus like some random app running on the, you know, thousands of crap Android phones out there. It'll never work.
Sure.
Or it's not that it'll never work. It'll just require so much more engineering effort that it's better to just do what we're doing or what Tesla's doing, which is just ship a set of hardware that's consistent across a big fleet.
Yeah. Because I was thinking actually that, I mean, more in lines with that. I'm like, Google has so much money. They could ship out, you know, 10,000, 100,000, a million devices like your device to, you know, to do basic lane keeping, collect the data, same thing as you do. But like, it seems like it's almost impossible for them to do what you're doing because of some cultural angle or some philosophical disagreements with, you know, how autonomous driving is going to be, you know, solved.
Google,
What's your take?
Google's also a dead organization. No one who's talented works at Google anymore, really, right? It's kind of like, no, it's, and like, it's true, right? Like, I go back 10 years ago, everyone wanted to work at Google.
Sure.
Now it's like, well, you know, they pay me a lot of money and I don't really have to work very hard. I mean, it sounds like, you know, it's like I lived long enough to see Google become IBM. So
where are people
like, you're not asking this question. Why isn't IBM doing it? IBM hasn't done anything in 50 years. Like,
that's true. I mean, the thing about Google, though, there still are a lot of smart people at Google. You know, they still attract like some of the smartest AI, you know, folks and some of the top engineers. I mean, you could say they're in decline, but to say like, you know, they don't have any smart people is kind of exaggeration. No?
No. So, okay, by the way, to talk about like there's definitely talented people at like DeepMind, which is a division of Google, right? There's some smart people at Google Brain too, but those aren't the people who have any power at Google, right? Like those people get to go there and do their research. There are smart people at Google. I guess what I more mean is there's no longer like smart people like, you know, running Google, you know. That's almost like DeepMind and Google Brain are almost like, that's not what I mean when I say Google, right? These are just these are Google's philanthropy projects, practically.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like
they're not.
Yeah, I mean, my read on Google is like more and more, you know, they've had the whole management types, the MBA types, the people who care about these certain metrics and, you know, certain goals, optimizing, you know, things to move up in the ranks, and that's kind of changed the culture of Google, where their optimization engine in the top ranks, more so than this crazy, you know, innovation, let's shoot for the moon type of, you know, early type of spirit. What's your take on Google with that?
I mean, I was there. I had an internship there in 2014. And like from when I was there in 2008, 2009, a bunch of internships, and a lot of people who worked there. And I watched what happened. And basically, and I know the fatal mistake Google made. Google kind of had a no politics ethos, right? It's like there's no politics at Google. And what happens when there's no politics is there's a politics vacuum. So these sort of, yeah, like the MBA types, the little get-aheaders, right? They were willing to play politics when these other people weren't, and they ended up taking over the organization, Right. And the other people, like, you know, and they also, like, it's the kind of person who has no kind of self-doubt, right? Like, Google was run by engineers. It's like, you know, let's actually think about this, right? Because they weren't making an ideological calculation. They were making a technical calculation. So Google got basically hijacked by these ideologues. One of the things I say at Comma to distinguish from this is there is a lot of politics at Comma. It is 100% mine, right? And there is zero tolerance for other politics. Right? But that's what you need. That's what you need, especially in the modern world. Otherwise, these kind of toxic people will creep in and subvert your organization.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me, you know, what's going on, like what your, some of your observations too, because like, you know, you've pointed out that you think that ultimately technology wins, right? I mean, the focus on that. And once you get an organization that loses that, the clarity on that idea, you know, it's really about the technology that gives the advantage. And you have a lot of MBA types who are, who've been grown up in a culture that it's not about per se technology. It's about a lot of other techniques and tactics and numbers and, you know, marketing and all this other stuff. You get into this organization where you no longer have that crazy technological focus that you did maybe in the very early days. And then contrast that to your company, Comma.ai, it's kind of like you won't let anything get in the way from you guys, you know, pushing the technology forward. And so it's kind of your advantage in some ways.
Yeah, it is. But I also think that this is not a, this is a common life cycle of companies kind of thing. You know, you have to work very hard to swim up to like push against this. You're swimming economically upstream if you want to do it, right? These people are better at extracting value.
Yeah.
But they'll extract value, they'll strip mine. They'll extract value at, you know, the example I always give is the Boeing 737 MAX and like who approved that, right? Like Boeing used to be a kind of company of a bunch of, you know, people who were like, we build good airplanes, we take pride in the airplanes we build. And it's taken over by these MBAs who's like, well, I can actually cut costs. Look, I can reuse the 737 frame and I can stick a big engine out forward. Oh, it's unstable. Fix it with software, right? And then.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I think Elon Musk is different, where you have this Tesla $80,000 employee company now, and he's kind of like still involved with engineering meetings, and he's still like, he's not giving over reins to, you know, management types to run the entire company, you know, he's still in charge. Like what other CEOs or leaders do you see have that type of focus? Like who are you bullish on in terms of, you know, leaders and CEOs out there?
Yeah, aside from Elon, really not that many. I mean, the problem I think is deeper and actually it's cultural. If people don't have a positive vision for the future, they're hopeless as a leader, right? Like Elon has a positive vision for the future and it's very clear what it is. Elon wants to drive his Tesla on Mars. Right. And that's, it's a vision that people can get behind. Right. And, you know, I want to have an AI girlfriend in virtual reality. Right. Maybe that's the postmodernist. But like I can talk about like a wild and fantastic future. And so can Elon. Right. And that's now, you know, you get to someone like Mark Zuckerberg. And please, Mark Zuckerberg, tell me about your vision for the future. Well, you know, everyone's going to be an ad to their, you know, like it's not there. Right. So, no, you can't. It's that. I do think a lot of cool stuff's happening in the crypto space, especially by these sort of like more anonymous people. Satoshi Nakamoto is the greatest entrepreneur of the century. You know, these people who effectively are disrupting government. I think that's the long-term goal of crypto. And like, there's a lot of cool stuff there.
Do you think we'll ever figure out who Satoshi Nakamoto was or is?
I think we kind of know. I don't think it really matters.
What's the most exciting crypto project or kind of thing that's happening that you're paying attention to? Is it Ethereum? Is it some type of other, you know, I don't know, game or?
I'm not an investor. I'm a no coiner. I'm not a crypto investor. I think the whole thing is just like, no, what I'm more interested in is you have all these people learning basically finance without going to Harvard, right? So Harvard might teach you some real stuff about finance, but they also indoctrinate you to a certain way of thinking, right? It's like, we teach you about, you know, the Fed and printing money, but, you know, you're in the boys club now, bro. You're in the club, man. Don't mess it up for everybody, right? Now you have these guys who are learning all the same stuff, but they ain't in the club. And they're like, we've been so scammed. I saw a great tweet on crypto Twitter, which is like, I don't care about getting rich. I just want to rug Goldman Sachs. Quality, right? This is the kind of, like, there's energy there, right?
I hear you.
I'm not going to like, I'm bullish on people thinking about governance, people thinking about finance, people thinking about what money is. You know, hyperinflate the US dollar. Sweet. We're fine.
Yeah, definitely. I think some of the biggest ideas are happening in crypto right now. Kind of under the cover somewhat, you know, it's not the traditional, like, they're not going on TechCrunch and raising, you know, the big round.
But that's what disruption looks like. Disruption, you can't have a startup playbook. By the time you have a startup playbook, you're not disrupting anything anymore. You are just part of the system.
Exactly.
But yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, I raised from this. Like in crypto, it's like, you took VC money. Bro, I got ICO from a DAO, bro. It's not ICO anymore. I got a DAO. I'm selling my governance token.
Are you ever on or have you followed Hacker News? News.ycombinator.com. It seems like it's a little bit of the life cycle like that too. Like, where in the beginning, Hacker News, like, you know, in late 2000s, early 2010s, was like the place, you know. It wasn't mainstream, you know, and then you got to this place where, you know, Y Combinator was pushing out hundreds, and basically tech crunch became mainstream, and it becomes this whole system where you attract people who aren't the same risk takers as, you know, 10 years ago. Absolutely. There's like, oh, it's just like Harvard. It's just like the Ivy League. Come on, there's no downside, you know, and the culture is formed where it's, and then they persecute those who are the, you know, what kind of started the whole thing, you know, in the beginning, kind of the big risk takers, and they move to a different arena. And one of those arenas could be crypto, you know, where you have this, you know, it's just a different culture, different ethos, different everything, you know. Fascinating stuff though. Yeah.
I think this is a normal life cycle thing. You know, I think that this has been going on forever. You know, what's cool about Comma is, you know, we're outside this. We're a profitable company. We control our own destiny. And I don't want to stop at self-driving cars. I want the home robotics. I think that's next, harder, much harder. You want a robot that's capable of sweep of taking a broom and sweeping the floor? Oh, that's real hard, right? Because driving, at least everybody drives the same road the same way.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe that's where the labeling comes in.
Oh, no. You can't do it with labeling. You can label even less there, right? Like, even the big data approaches that we're using for driving don't really work for like home cooking and cleaning robots, you know? Mm. Like, that's what I want to do next, right? And then, like, cooking and cleaning, and then there's like, okay, so there's like, you know, maybe there's like the games, like Go, driving, like cooking and cleaning, and then general AI. Mm. You know, I bought some land 30 minutes east, and like, you know, I'm out there, like, look, I slice my hand up, you know, digging a hole for a foundation for a concrete slab, right? Like, well, I don't have a robot doing this for me. It's like, you can get a heavy machine in there and you can do it with a machine, but they're just not maneuverable. They're not smart. Yeah. We'll get there.
What do you think of the Neuralink, Elon Musk's Neuralink? Do you think like uploading our mind or Neuralink is going to play a role?
All right. So I'm very happy somebody's doing this, building high bandwidth brain interfaces. I don't think they're going to have the goal Elon says. Basically, I gave a South by presentation like 10 years ago, basically like talking about high bandwidth links to the brain, and I was wrong. But it's not like I realized way afterward that I was wrong. And I think Elon's wrong the same way about Neuralink. For example, let's say you want to read a book, right? So there's some Neuralink thing you can put in and it can like download the book right to your brain, high bandwidth interface. But then you realize that the limit of how fast you can read a book has nothing to do with your eyes. You can look at the whole page easily. Right? Your reading speed is not limited by your input bandwidth. So just putting a Neuralink in is not going to let you read books faster. It's limited by some much deeper process in the brain. And yes, there is long-term brain augmentation, but you're going to need more compute. It's not a bandwidth question.
Okay, so there's so many topics here. So, I mean, okay, on output, though, you would say a brain-machine interface could help immensely with the output speed, right? Because think about it.
Not really.
Me talking is, like, so cumbersome compared to, like...
No, it's not. It's not. I don't think so.
Really? Because I always struggle with typing too. It's like it's such a pain. Like, you know, my thoughts go 10 times faster than what I could talk or what I could put down in writing.
I don't think they actually do. Like it feels that way, but then like, so I stream a lot. I stream on Twitch. I stream my programming on Twitch and I watch some of my videos and like my speed at which I can program has almost nothing to do with my typing speed.
Well, programming is, it takes a lot of like, you know, thinking and solving, problem solving.
But so does anything, right?
Sometimes expression, you could, you know, for example, I have something to express. I could, if I had a Neuralink in 30 seconds, I could come up with a wide expression that would take me 30 minutes to type.
I don't think so. I think if you want to write a lot of fluff, you could already use something like a GPT-3. Right? Like there's tools that are external that can already get you like a lot of expounded fluff. Like you want to write like a 5-paragraph essay. Yeah, maybe you can think that through faster than you can type. But if you're thinking faster than you can type, even if you could like Neuralink it out on the page, it would be mostly gibberish. Right? Like most of your time to come up with any like real coherent expression, the Neuralink may actually help you write like, I don't know. I don't think I can think of words faster than I can say them.
Really, huh?
But do you think we'll think in other ways other than in words? Do you think we'll think a little more naturally, like as if words didn't exist and that could be communicated?
Here's an interesting one. So like editor technology, right? A lot of times when I program, I still use Vim. It's the same Vim from the 70s. Right, like it hasn't gotten better because that's not the limiting factor. The limiting factor is your internal thought process and not your input or output speed, assuming you're a neurotypical human, right? If you are blind and deaf, oh yes, there are much higher bandwidth brain ways to get into your mind. Or if you like can't, you know, type normally and like you can spend a bit of time and you can like practice this too. Like it took me time to like learn to move fast in editors and stuff, but like I don't think I could do it faster with the brain interface.
I mean, okay, so there's a few things here. I mean, I agree in the sense that it's not just only bandwidth. There's a mechanism that, you know, of learning, of comprehension, understanding, retainment, et cetera, that's not just a, you know, input-output, you know, issue here. But I would say with the brain machine interface like Neuralink, like it could perhaps input, maybe not, you know, 100 times faster, but maybe at some speed faster, but then it can work on the retention, the retainment, the clarity by maybe gauging feedback on how the brain is receiving that or actually, you know, retaining that and customizing the actual input to radically improve how you communicate and learn.
Yes, and you can do all of those exact same things with a monitor, a keyboard, and a mouse. It's really hard, right? Like, when I'm using like a program, wouldn't it be great if the program could like learn the way I use it and make it easier for me? Yeah, that sounds great, right? But again, it doesn't require a brain computer interface to do it. It turns out that that software is so hard to write.
Okay, let's take an example of learning a new language. Yeah. Let's say I want to learn Japanese or something. Yep. Mm-hmm. And like the problem is like if I could have a Neuralink in my head, and let's say we assume it's just not speeding up the actual input, but it's just, you know, let's say feeding me stuff, but then it's actually able to read what my brain is like. Let's say it gives some inputs like, did you remember, what is this? And your brain doesn't remember. Yeah. So it's able to target exactly what you need to learn and repeat it or do it in the right way that your brain needs to learn. So the speed improvement would be like 100x. Like
The speed improvement would be great, but what you just described to me was a private tutor. A private tutor can do all those things as well, but you don't need it in your head. The problem has nothing. If you have a person sitting next to you who's like, I'm very talented at teaching and, you know, is fluent in Japanese and English, that person could teach you Japanese great. That person could help you through. It's like, you know, it's like having a personal trainer, right? But like, it has nothing to do with it being in your head. What you're describing is a piece of software. It doesn't matter if the interface is here or here. Same.
No, I would agree, but the key thing is you're just solving for the latency.
But it's not the latency.
You know, in terms of the tutor, for example, the Japanese tutor on my computer, there's I have to say, they have to process it, say it back. In my brain, the feedback will be nearly instantaneous. Like, and compound the benefits of that saving of, you know, the feedback speed over millions and millions of interactions. You can't compare the two.
I don't think this is true. I think that when you are talking and when you are like the tutor's asking you if you understand and you're talking back, that's kind of when you are learning. I'm not sure this process can go any faster. But the reason tutors are much better than like a, you know, learn Japanese course is the learn Japanese course is not interactive and it doesn't track what you've retained and what you haven't. But all that is the tutor using their 20 petaflops of compute to like assist learning you, and this stuff works great and we could build great technologies there, but again, the brain interface is going to give you a very negligible, if any, speed up. Like, because also I think there might be a difference if you put the brain interface in babies and you like did it from birth, but to try to like learn this new paradigm when you're older, I just don't ever really see it being faster than the ones you're already good at.
Sure. I mean, I guess there's two big things going on, which is the whole, let's say the tutor, the Japanese tutor becoming an AI, or, you know, where the AI is able to teach us
AI teachers could be incredible.
Yeah, exactly, customizable to, you know, how I learn and in the right way, right speed, right repetition, retention, everything perfectly to the point where it's like trying to maximize Japanese learning. So that's one area of concept. But then the other areas, I guess you're saying is unclear if a brain machine interface would really, you know, significantly improve the effectiveness, right, of, let's say, a Japanese tutor AI.
My central thesis here is that the brain's limitation has nothing to do with bandwidth and everything to do with compute. So if you're adding external compute, it helps. If you're increasing bandwidth or decreasing latency, it's marginal.
Yeah. I mean, I would disagree with the latency. I think because there's, by nature, communication, you know, it has so much latency, so much inherent delay that it's just like over billions and trillions of interactions. It adds up to, you know, most of history.
At most, you're talking like a 2x. You're not going to 100x. But you ever watch two people who are good friends and the way they'll communicate is kind of almost in like a pigeon? Like they're not like speaking in full sentences because they've made more efficient communication for themselves, right? Or like, you know, when you talk to like a girlfriend, it's like the same, like, you know, we've been for a long time. But you can say much more in less words.
Sure. I mean, yeah. Originally when I heard in an interview, like your whole thing of, you know, wanting a AI girlfriend in the future, I was like, what the heck? But then after listening to you more in a few other interviews and thinking about it, I'm thinking your idea is you're looking at this AI who's able to interact with you on such a personal, customizable level where it maximizes your best, the best in you, right? It maximizes your happiness, your intimacy, your connection, makes you feel, you know, a certain way in a way that is superhuman to the point where, you know, and is that kind of...
That's exactly right. When I say AI girlfriend, like, I like this phrase because like there's some people right away who will dismiss it as like sex bot crap, which, you know, might be fun. But no, really, when I think about an AI girlfriend, I think about that's the closest I'm going to get to uploading without anything like crazy. Right. Because I don't think that my limitations really have anything to do with like my physical interfaces. I don't want to drill holes in my head if I don't have to. I don't think I have to. I think that like with another sort of AI person, we kind of like become one, and that's what merging with the machine looks like. I like the term AI girlfriend because that's the closest analogy in the real world right now. Right?
You ever like that movie Her?
Yeah. And or you can, like, I just know couples, like real world couples, two people. It's like they become kind of like one person. And I start to think about them as one person. I think it's a pretty typical human experience. So, like, that's like what I imagine.
Okay. All right. So I want to say push back, but to come from a different angle here. Do you think AI will be complete in the sense that it can actually, I want to say just mimic, but actually be as, in the qualitative sense, as intimate and deep as a connection as a human? Let me rephrase this. I'm not saying all humans, but certain humans, like there's a, perhaps a soul element or a spirit element to humans that I think it's unclear exactly, you know, if this is programmable, you know, or not. Some people might say it is. Some people might say this is actually from a different, you know, completely dimension or something. Like, do you think your AI girlfriend in the future will be a, I would say a distorted experience, lacking kind of this, you know, this connection of soul and spirit? Or do you think it will be a complete, I mean, it's going to feel complete because, you know, AI is going to be able to customize and personalize to them, to your perception. But do you think it will be, I would say subpar is not the right word because a lot of human interactions are very subpar in relationships, you know, I mean, a lot of them are just terrible. Yeah. And, but I'm just saying, like, in an ideal human to human relationship, I don't even know if that's possible per se, but like, would there be a difference at all, you know, compared to your AI girlfriend?
Not when they're finished. When they're finished, it'll be beyond anything I've ever experienced. Of course not, right? Like, I'm a naturalist, right? Like, there's no soul from a higher dimension. Like, it'd be cool if there was, but I don't think it's true.
Like, is that provable, though? Is that just your assumption? I guess that's what I'm saying.
I mean, okay, so it depends what you accept as a proof, right? If you accept as a proof that, like, there's some people who will say that even though the machine perfectly mimics a person, it doesn't have some je ne sais quoi. And like, to them, I'm like, you know, I just can't, like there's no engaging with that kind of argument, right? Like there's no, I think this is a like philosophy thing. Like if two things are, there's no test that I can do to tell them apart, they are the same, right? So like, in the sense of, yes, how it will feel and how it will be complete. And then once it becomes superhuman, it will be beyond complete.
Yeah. I mean, like, for example, take the Turing test. You can't, let's say, tell the difference between, let's say, this AI in every facet, right?
Yeah.
Compared to a human. My qualm, or the thing I question a little bit is what if 99.99% of people can't tell the difference? But what if it is possible for the 0.0001% to spot a difference? Like in that type of scenario, you know, it passes the Turing test. For most people, it is real in the sense of, you know, it is what it is. But they don't. When you're in the belief system, you've already kind of concluded that this is the best of the best. I'm just saying that. It doesn't necessarily prove that that is, you know, perfect or something. I'm just saying, to me, there's a lot of assumptions along the way. I don't know. What's your take?
I think there's some people who probably already there's machines that can pass the Turing test for. I think they're actually in a minority of the population, I think. But no, as the AIs become more and more intelligent, they will be able to convince more and more people until eventually there'll be a point where, okay, like you can look at chess, right? Like there was a point where, you know, a hobbyist chess player could beat the best computer, right? You go back to like the 80s, this was true. Then there was a point where, like, you know, no amateur had won against a computer for a while, but they still hadn't beat the professionals. And they beat the professionals, but it was still close. And now we're at a point where there is no way the best chess player in the world loses to my iPhone. Like, yeah.
I think it's fascinating watching some of these Alpha Go or Alpha Zero chess games. If you watch some of the moves, I play chess sometimes, but if you watch some of the moves they do in openings, it's pretty interesting just to watch.
Alpha Zero is one of the most wild results of like the last couple of years. The fact that the thing relearned all of chess theory. in like a training, right? They didn't like study openings. They figured it all out. And yeah, it's crazy watching some of those games that I wish I knew more about chess and could appreciate it even more deeply. But like, I can certainly tell the difference between like an alpha, a zero game and a Stockfish game. Like I could just look at it and see like the way it's playing and you know.
So I want to talk about this. So these levels, so you have AGI, artificial general intelligence, you have cleaning and, you know, cooking robots. Below that, you have driving. cleaning, cooking robots, like why, like how do you look at that step from driving to cleaning and cooking? Like what are the things that need to be fixed or solved in order to get there? And why is it so hard? I mean, to me, it sounds like crazy. I wouldn't say crazy, but like to chop vegetables in the right way to to be able to even taste. I don't know. Where does all this head? Where is all this head? And how long is it going to take, you think?
So to go into why it's harder. So I feel that Comma solved self-driving cars 3 years ago. Now we're just implementing it. Like we had a full solution on the board. It was like pretty clear what it was. Like I'm happy with it. We just actually have to like do it. It's not like that easy. It's a lot of code and a lot of debugging. With cooking and cleaning, it's much, much harder because with driving, you have a existing policy to match. And like the goal is pretty obvious, right? Like the reward function in driving given a human policy is pretty easy. Right. Whereas this isn't true about cooking at all. Do I want to chop peppers or do I want to chop onions? Who knows? Right. Like with driving, you can say, like, do I want to go straight or do I want to turn here? I can do that with an old school nav system. Like this is no problem. Right. There is no equivalent to a nav system for cooking. You could say there's a recipe, but no, it's not like when a nav system tells you to take an exit, almost everyone's going to take the exit in the exact same way. When the recipe tells you to chop an onion, everybody's going to do it radically differently. They're going to pick a different knife. They're going to have to go to a different place for the onion. It's so much harder in this kind of reward space, right? Like it's easy to show the AI the difference between like good driving and bad driving. It's very hard to show the AI the difference between good cooking and bad cooking.
Mm-hmm. Got it. I mean, are you looking to get into the making the physical robots as well?
Again, I think the whole problem is software. I have the same thing with driving. I just, in the same way, am I interested in building physical cars? Not really. Right, like stick it on an existing car. The robots today are okay. I mean, you could probably build like a better one, but especially when we start thinking about this in a few years, there'll be some like decent bodies. You know, when you look at our devices, I think of them as little heads. You know, it's a little head. It's got like an eye and a microphone and a speaker and it's a little we build heads and we'll stick them on bodies that hopefully I can buy off the shelf, right? Like this is what we did with driving. And yeah, but I don't know. I mean, this stuff, let's solve self-driving first. Let's make sure all this stuff works out. We haven't started on it, but it is what I'm thinking about.
Like being the Android of robots, perhaps.
Yeah, right. And then that's a little like let's first solve self-driving cars and show that we can do that, right? Like no resources are being put on robotics now. I just think about it in my spare time. But I think it's the cool follow-up. I think it's also the cool follow-up to like when we do complete the company mission of solve self-driving cars while delivering shippable intermediaries. The next step is not going to be now exit scam for as much money as we can. No, absolutely not. And anybody who starts to think like that, I'll fire tomorrow. Right? And there will be people who do. There will be people who do. There'll be people who like, oh, this was our goal the whole time. And I'll be like, hey, get the fuck out. We got something new to do, right? Until we solve AI and I have my AI girlfriend, I live in virtual reality, right?
Got it. How do you see the end, I don't say the end game, but yeah, long-term thing of delivery, let's say food delivery or package delivery, like, you know, what happens? What is it, drone? Is it, you know, just a car and then a robot to the front door, or is it just they drop it off at a place where people have to come out to get? Like, how do you envision the last foot, I guess, problem with delivery?
I think drones are much smarter than cars for delivery. Yeah, I think it's mostly, you know, it's like just we have some like antiquated regulations and stuff why we don't have them. The self-driving problem for drones is a lot easier than the self-driving problem for cars, Like we have good self-driving drones today because it's a whole lot easier when you can, you're in three dimensions instead of two dimensions, right? Avoiding a collision in two dimensions is a lot harder than avoiding a collision in three dimensions, right? Imagine trying to avoid a collision in one dimension. It's impossible. The two dimensions is much harder to reason about than the three dimensions. These drones are also super maneuverable. I do see that as the future for delivery. When the regulations fix themselves.
Apple. So, you know, there's all this talk over the years of Apple trying to come up with a car, getting into perhaps autonomous driving as well. They're taking forever though. It's like 2021.
Apple's not going to ship.
Like, what do you think?
They're not going to ship the car, and they're not going to ship the car not because they can't do it, but Apple runs into this interesting problem. As a business, and I don't think they'll do it for business reasons. So Apple, I hear for every one Apple product that ships, there's two more that like are complete but got canceled. And I think the problem with the Apple car is, well, okay, so Apple's not going to sell a $30,000 car. They're going to sell an $80,000 car, right? How big is the market for $80,000 cars? It's not that big. There's just not that many people that can afford them. And this goes against Apple's whole ethos of luxury for everybody, right? Everybody, no matter how poor, can afford an iPhone. Because an iPhone just is actually not that expensive. Even if you want like a really nice iPhone, right? Like it's $1,000. I shouldn't say everybody, but everybody in America, right? Like everybody in America can afford an iPhone. There are some people who just will never be able to buy an $80,000 car. And I think that it hurts Apple's brand. And I don't think it'd be a smart move for them. I mean, or they could ship a $30,000 car, but then it's going to be crap. And, you know, that hurts Apple's brand in another way, right? Like,
got it. I mean, it seems like one of the big problems is Tesla already kind of established themselves with a great product. If Tesla wasn't in the market, then there could be kind of a more easier opening, right, for Apple to come in to establish itself.
I still don't think so. I think that fundamentally Apple's brand equity would suffer too much in shipping a car, right? No matter whether they ship a cheap car or an expensive car, their brand suffers in both ways and it's just not worth it for them. So it's not like Tesla could do it because Tesla had no brand. Tesla built a brand around this, whereas Apple's just already so established that like it's not worth it as a business.
Yeah, interesting. Fascinating stuff. I mean, sometimes when I've listened to a few of your interviews, like when you talk about business and strategy or even like assessing companies, like it seems like you think about some of this stuff. Like, are there any influential books or thinkers or podcasts or anything that you read in terms on the business side, not the technical side at all?
It's such trash. Oh, the way people think about, really the best things to read are like, business and politics are pretty similar. There is some, I'm not going to, you know, say what it is or where it is, but there's good high-end political thinking out there. And then to understand this lets you understand business.
Okay. All right.
You can find it. If you're ready for it. There are like truths in the world. I think that a lot of it comes down to so much of business is about self-delusion. All these books they're not books that tell you anything about business. They're self-help books. Self-help is the most stupid genre. Like it makes you feel good without, you know, doing anything, right? So there's not books that actually explain like how business works. Also because like, you know, no one who knows anything about business is writing that book. Right? Like, you just kind of got to like look around and think through things. There's also one of my quotes from one of my blog posts is, you know, 95% of the people I would meet in the hacker world were good people. 5% were bad. The business world has this reversed. Almost everyone I meet in the business world is a complete scumbag. And like, well, but it's interesting why. It's because that's what the pressures select for. But the hacker world is this like merit-based thing where, you know, people look at you based on, your skill and like, you know, people, but the business world is like, you know, you can use these super scummy tactics to get ahead. And that's what it selects for. And that's why people are like that. So no, if you want to understand business, like, you know, don't, if you want to understand business, understand politics. And if you think what you're doing to understand politics is understanding politics, it's probably wrong. Right. If you're reading any sort of like thing that would be called as politics, I read CNN, I stay informed. No, you don't. That's propaganda. Now, okay, now start figuring out, okay, who's pushing this problem? Well, I don't read CNN. I know that's fake. I watch Fox News. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's all good thinking there, bro. You know, you're reading the other propaganda, right?
Got it. What's your take on Chinese EV makers and their autonomous driving plans? Have you looked at into them at all? Like, I know Baidu and Huawei and...
Oh, those are the scam ones. No, there's real Chinese ones. Who's it? NIO? NIO Pilot? Yeah, that's legit. This is the Tesla of China. The thing looks great. So I think that, yeah, again, it's the same, like the same scams are going on in the Chinese autonomy world as the American autonomy world. And you have like Pony AI and what was that other one in started in Palo Alto? These like overfunded scam Chinese exist. And then there's like NIO. Like, look, like we ship a car. It's a pretty good car. And now we got a sick autopilot for it. Great. I want a NIO. When you ship it to America, I'll buy one. Tesla's got to make, you know, Tesla's got to fix the road noise in their cars. I want Tesla to make a real luxury car. I got to drive a Model S Plaid. Maybe I'd like it.
Yeah, I have one. It's the road noise is very, you know, much improved, I would say.
Oh, they did a good job? Plaid.
Yeah, oh, very good.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. That's great.
Yeah, you got to try it. Yeah.
Emmett's had like six Teslas and yeah.
Yeah, I get the newest one every time they come out. I trade it in for the newer one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's great to hear. Like, I drove a 3, and I was like, I can't, this is like my Sonata's nice and quiet, you know?
Yeah.
Even the X, it's not a luxury car. When Tesla comes out with a real luxury car, I'm interested.
Yeah, no, maybe there's certain aspects of the X or the old S that were not luxury-like with the noise, but I would say the Plaid, I feel like they've conquered all that, yeah.
Cool, I should buy one.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you think Tesla will license their autonomous driving tech to other OEMs eventually, or do you think they'll just keep it to themselves?
No, I think it would be a bad idea. Did Apple license iOS?
No. I mean, they tried to license Macintosh way back in the day.
Yeah.
Which was kind of a fail there, but.
Yeah. Oh, I forget. Oh, what were those knockoff, like PowerPC? There was like a knockoff. I'm trying to remember. PowerMac. Yeah. Yeah, I think that what's really going to happen is there was a good tweet. I think it was a Paul Graham tweet where it's like all these legacy automakers, like they think they're behind Tesla because of the battery technology, right? But they're also 5 years behind in autonomy, in the operating system, in OTA updates, right? There's like a huge list of things. So to think that you could just pick and choose one piece of Tesla and license it to somebody and they'd be able to build it, it's just not, I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think it makes sense from like Tesla's perspective either. Like, why are you wasting your time trying to get like autopilot working on like, you know, the Mercedes E-Class? Like,
about to license their superchargers to other EVs and we'll see how that goes, I guess.
Now that's a better idea. That's a much better idea. Because yeah. You know, licensing autopilot is the integration required is huge. Licensing a supercharger, it's like, yo, plug in and pay me overpriced for power. Like, this is great.
Yeah.
And then Tesla could reinvest that and grow the supercharger network, right? It's very clear how capital improves the supercharger network. It's very unclear how capital improves autonomy. And this is the common, like you say, it's like for 20 people. It's like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, I have this strong conviction, and maybe Dave does too, that we think Tesla will be the largest company in the world by the end of the decade, if not sooner. Do you agree, or do you think it's a crapshoot, or what are your thoughts on Tesla's future long term?
Well, who's the current largest company? Apple? I wouldn't put it. I wouldn't say it's impossible. I think that Tesla stock's overvalued right now. I think Elon might even agree. What I want to see, I got to drive a Plaid. What I want to see, if Tesla can figure out, so okay, I drive a Hyundai Sonata. Or I used to have a Mercedes S-Class, right? Mm-hmm. I would rather have a Hyundai Sonata with OpenPilot than a Mercedes S-Class. If Tesla's also still a little like rough around the edges in places. Like if Tesla can deliver a polished high-end experience at an affordable price, then I could see them doing it, right? Being the largest company. And because who delivers a polished high-end experience at an affordable price? Apple. But Tesla still, it feels still, it's a little too janky. Like when you compare it to it, it feels more like a Google Pixel than an iPhone. I was in the Model 3 and like the sound daemon crashed and autopilot stopped making sounds. Like, are you kidding me? Like, yeah. Like, you know, fix this stuff. And they can do it. Look, my money's on Tesla to do it, but they have to do it.
Yeah.
I think what year Model 3 were you in? Was it an earlier model, you think?
2019.
Yeah, because I have a December 2017, but I've noticed it's improved a lot actually over the years, like even with the sound and some other stuff.
Oh, I mean, the sound thing was just software. The sound thing was entirely software. It had nothing to do with the build here or the car.
Yeah, but just the overall, you know, experience and build. I mean, it's interesting. With Tesla, I guess it's there are definitely, I guess, ways Tesla can improve the overall experience. What do you think? I mean, what can, in your opinion, you're saying Apple still has this polished high-end experience. Tesla, you think, is a little bit down. Like, what can Tesla do to close this gap?
It's all about user experience, right? And a lot of my critiques of autopilot, when I did an autopilot test, right? Like on the highway, the user experience is fine. I don't like touching the wheel. Like, when are you going to really roll out your camera-based DM? Right. Like, and then, you know, I know they are, but oh, they didn't put any infrared LEDs on it. Oh, well, you should have done that. Right. Like we did that on our last product. Here's another area where we're ahead of Tesla. Right. It's like we've had camera based DM now for quite a while. And like, it's just going to take Tesla 2 years to make that good. The new cars are all going to ship with IR cameras and LEDs and it's going to be good. But like, I think there should be a lot more thought into the user experience of the car, and this is where Apple's putting a lot of thought in that Tesla's not.
I mean, I guess it's relative in some ways. I mean, if you look at December 2017 Model 3, I've got this beautiful screen, beautiful, you know, interface. I've got 8 cameras equipped, you know, with the right hardware and camera setup in December 2017. The user experience in some ways is like fantastic. You know, I just get into my Tesla. There are some rough edges where, you know, my trunk was having a hard time opening, closing exactly the way I wanted, or it was like louder than I expected, so I had to put some extra sound seal.
Right, like I'm buying a Mercedes, man. Like I'm not dealing with any of this, you know. I'm rich. Like,
I guess. I mean, for me, it's like well worth it because, like, you know, yeah, I wouldn't want a Mercedes, but I don't know. I understand though, definitely.
Well, I wouldn't want a Mercedes for the lack of autonomy, right? Like that's my main problem with like these cars. I can't buy any car today that doesn't have OpenPilot support. But like, I don't know. And maybe this is just my preferences as a consumer, but I'm very much more on the make driving chill side of things than on the look at this crazy feature side of things, right? If, yeah. Like I'm driving an S-Class, not a G-Wagon, you know.
Yeah. Tesla has their AI day coming up August 19th, I think. Elon just announced it. Elon's also been tweeting about Tesla becoming the leader in real world AI. He's been talking a lot about that, physical world AI. Like, what's your take on that? Do you think Tesla is the leader in real world AI? Do you think that's important? Do you think there's a distinction between real world physical AI, let's say, versus more digital online? What's your angle?
Elon's thinking about the same stuff I am. We're all thinking about cleaning robots, right? Real world AI, right? Like, no, Elon's thinking about the exact same thing I am. So, you know. Uh-huh. Well, he talks with Grimes about his AI girlfriend. It's the same shit. Like, yeah. So is Tesla a leader in real world AI? I mean, yes. Autopilot and OpenPilot are some of the only, like, products that have, like, you know, like, shipped neural nets interacting with the real world. I think that they can do stuff to like they should sell their chips. I've said this for a long time, like sell your chip. You want to become a leader, like branch out, move away from being vertically integrated. But again, I don't think, and that's even more obvious to me than licensing autopilot, to like sell your chips, you know, and make 50% margins on them, but do it and they won't.
They might open up their dojo?
No. Opening it up for a cloud is completely useless. Nobody wants this, right? They're going to find what? How are you going to get your data there? Right? Are they going to also offer a storage product? Like, it's very hard. Look at how much money Microsoft poured into Azure. And like, is it still, okay, there's Azure and there's AWS, right? And then like Google Cloud's way down here, and this has to do with some, you know, philosophical problems at Google. You know, Google's a services, not a platforms company, right? Amazon's a platforms company, so is Microsoft. So this is why AWS and Azure are the top two, right? And like, there's no way Tesla can compete. Unless they're willing to burn. Microsoft only managed to compete with Amazon by burning billions and billions of dollars to do it. We know, Comma got $500,000 in Azure credit. Thank you, Microsoft. And you know what? We're a loyal Azure company. I pay $25K a month for Azure. Like, yeah.
Awesome. Okay. Nice. So real world AI. So you said before you think like, you know, it's driving, cleaning, cooking robots, and then AGI. Why does it need to go through, you think, the cleaning, cooking robots before AGI? And do you think those companies, for example, the Googles and others who aren't necessarily doing the physical, you know, robot AIs, will they just focus on, maybe you're saying like the software is the important thing, so maybe they have other people make the hardware, right? But yeah, what's the road? Why the path through cleaning and cooking robots?
Well, so, I mean, I think OpenAI now is a bunch of jokers. I think DeepMind, I think Demis Hassabis has a very kind of clear strategy, and he doesn't believe in the necessary, he doesn't believe physical AI. He thinks that AI is all a set of games. Of increasing complexity. And you know what? For the most part, I agree with him. On a, like if you talk about, like, you know, Elon and the modernist and me and the postmodernist, and like, you know, Demis Hassabis is like further over here. I don't know. I mean, for me, like, I like the idea of physicality because it's physicality that improves my life. One of the things that I always bring up when I talk about how, like, I live better than the King of France, because I have an HVAC system. HVAC, now I'm talking, right? Like, whoever built HVAC, I like that guy, right? So like, I'm into the physicality like that, but for most people's definition of AGI, does it require physicality? We'll see. But again, it's the kind of things that I want to build, the physical things, because I think they're cool and useful.
Yeah. So do you think Tesla will start to roll out their own robots in manufacturing and maybe logistics, their own type of, you know, behind the scenes first before really going into a consumer product eventually?
We're saying all the same things. Like, we got our, you know, a new device that we're building, and I'm like, one day we're going to have these devices building more of these devices, right? Like, hey, that's going to be nice, right? Like, that's what I'm excited about. But yeah, you know, they build themselves. So yeah, I think Tesla's thinking a lot of the same stuff.
Hey, so I just got done reading this book. It's called Genius Makers. And it talks about kind of this crazy cutthroat competition in the past 10 years regarding AI talent and just people, you know, sucking up anyone they can. I'm curious, with Comma.ai, have you had any difficulties finding like the top talent that you need? Like, how do you find great software engineers and also, you know, say machine learning experts?
Or do they find you?
Yeah, top talent is overrated, right? Like, anyone who like brands themselves as like top talent, you know, those are the kind of people who are like on speaking tours and like they spend a lot of time on their speaking tours and their blogs and stuff, you know? Comma is almost all reach in. We do very little outreach. People hear about us and look, here's what we have to offer. You're going to come work at a company where the goal of the company is solving the problem, right? Like, there's not going to be bullshit because the goal of the company is solving, you know, there's no other goals. You're an engineer. You come work at Comma. You're not subservient to some management class. You're not being bossed around by the whim of stupid markets. You're never going to have to make the dumb feature that like, oh, well, you know, we did some user testing and users want this dumb feature. Sorry, engineers. I know it sucks, but you have to build it. No, like, we don't do anything like that. So, you know, that's the cool thing about coming to work at Comma, right? Like, you can go work at these Google, you know, these like Google Brain. Yeah, okay, okay, you can work most of the time on your research paper, but someone's got to improve the YouTube spam comment classifier. Comma, there's none of that. You know, you're here and you're working on solving self-driving cars. I also think a lot of what people think of as machine learning talent is kind of wrong. Machine learning is not a math problem, it's an infrastructure problem. The math is relatively simple. You know, if you paid attention in high school, like, you know, like the basics of linear algebra and calculus, right? Enough to like do all the math you need for AI. Oh, you want to process, you know, 10 petabytes of data? Ooh, well, you know, you're good with Docker, bro? like it's that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Got it. Are you concerned at all with AI when it gets to the point where it's going to be difficult for humans to tell the difference, or they can't tell the difference between AI produced content and human produced content, and you know how that gets into the hands of, it basically empowers, you know, those who know how to use media to influence, control thought and direction of society in a very empowered way. Have you thought about that? Does that concern you, or do you think regulation will just come into play?
Regulation. Ooh, those are the exact kind of people who I worry about. Ah, oh, wow. You know, like all weapons, like, you know, it wasn't like some tinkerer who, like, you know, dropped the nukes. It was governments, right? It wasn't, it wasn't like some random dude who like firebombed Berlin. It was governments. It wasn't, like some company who sent people to die in the trenches in World War II in France. It was governments, right? So who am I worried about with AI? Well, you know, the same people who've used weapons to kill millions of people before, right? But I don't think there's anything special about AI that makes it really any different from, like, I used to be more afraid of like the like runaway superhuman intelligence. And then like I've learned more about how like the real world works. And it's like, well, this is just like any other weapon. And like, yes, these, you know, let's hope we can do a better job of decentralizing it, not centralizing it this time. Mm-hmm. I don't think about it, but like, you know, it's offense and defense. Are we going to live in a world of global tyranny? Yeah, maybe. I don't know. What can I do about it, right? I don't think that there's any. I think that the dumbest way to think about this is we should stop building technology. Right? Like some people have, we should stop. Okay, well, A, like that isn't desirable because, like, I don't know, I like technology, HVAC, you know. But B, it also won't work. Right, like what you're proposing is a form of arms control, which has never in history worked. You're never going to have arms control. Oh, yes, we'll pass a worldwide treaty to ban the development of AI for manipulation of civilians. Right? They do it fine without AI today. They've been doing it fine ever since at least the 30s.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, if you take, you know, a more critical or view of government, you know, the idea is historically you regulate everything, the government regulates everything underneath it, but them themselves aren't really regulated in its top form, you know, so it comes to the point where, you know, weapons underneath the government, everyone under is regulated, but then the government itself can use whatever weapons, you know, they choose, because who's telling the government, you know?
Well, it's the idea of sovereignty. Yeah,
besides its own, you know, legal system, I guess. Metaverse. So, you know, it seems like, you know, we're headed in this direction where people are living these, I want to say alternative existences, but people are like, these games out there are so intense and comprehensive in some ways, where, you know, you have people living like lives, like most of their waking hours is inside a game. And the technology to make this more high fidelity is just inevitable. You know, every year this is just improving at a radical pace. Where do you see this all headed in terms of the idea of a metaverse? What is, and also I'm curious, what do you think is going to be the thing that really pushes it, or takes it off to a whole nother level? What's the breakout kind of?
What games are you talking about? I've been so disappointed with games lately.
Really? I mean, just like, for example, like all my, I mean, I don't play much games, but like all my friends, kids all are into Fortnite.
Yeah. You ever play Fortnite?
not me, personally, but
Fortnite's not a world build. Like Minecraft's kind of cool. But like Fortnite, it's this like terribly repetitive, addictive thing. It's not right. I remember when World of Warcraft came out in like 2005. I was in the beta. I like loved this. Was an expansive world. I still haven't seen anything that competes with World of Warcraft from 16 years ago. Because the gaming industry has taken a different direction. The gaming industry has, again, been taken over really by MBAs who are like, yes, let's sell them skins. Let's get them in on micropayments. Yes. And you have that kind of mentality across the whole gaming industry. And I think the games are kind of terrible. With Minecraft, kind of is this. There's a lot of kids in playing Minecraft these days. And that's cool. That's a world-building metaverse-y game. But like, they still haven't really launched like the MMO Minecraft, which they could do.
What do you think about Roblox? Do you have any opinion on Roblox? Kind of, they're building like a platform of games and social experiences, sort of like the App Store Apple built, but like a platform for hundreds of thousands of developers to kind of create experiences and games for kids.
How is this different from the Roblox Store?
No, this is its own software. Roblox, its own ecosystem.
No. But how is it different from like Steam Online Store?
I mean, it's more accessible to kids, I think. My kids who are 5, 7, and 9 play it all the time, and it's just a button they press on their iPad, and they get instantly, they have hundreds of experiences to pick from with their friends, It's pretty simple for them to use.
What I haven't seen, I think mobile gaming is this terrible blight on gaming. Like, these games are so simplistic compared to what we had. Even like, you can play like Super Mario 64 on N64, and they built like this elaborate world that, and I feel the same kind of thing with movies, like older movies, they would like build this complex, amazing world. And today's movies are like, look, we blew this up. Look at these special effects, bro. They're so good. And I'm like, I can't follow this plot at all. Like, there's not even like a plot, And then I think video games are the same way. It's like, they're trying to like hook you with these, like, build me a world I care about. I still haven't seen things that compete with like World of Warcraft, Second Life, RuneScape, MapleStory, that era of MMOs. Now all the MMOs are like Kickstarter scams. I don't know. Roblox, hey, if there's something cool, I'll try it. I'm very excited about the potential for gaming, but I haven't seen that's where the game industry is going. I'm excited for, like,
I you probably won't find the whole MMO like games on Roblox. I mean, Roblox is more like the way you look at it is it's creating its own kind of developer ecosystem where you have the tools, all of the services all built in. So you don't have to worry about, any of the foundation infrastructure stuff of building a game, right? And you have the audience, the marketing distribution to solve too. So you're just kind of focused on the experience itself. But the games are still very far from, big.
They're very simple.
This is what I mean. Like, I think the gaming industry has taken steps backwards. I mean, you can do the same thing. Like Unity is pretty good. These engines are pretty good now. But like when I compare this, a game that I still like, GTA 5, like that was a great game. But like, they built this expansive world that sucks you in. It was like amazing. I'm excited for GTA 6, and I hope they do that again. But like, now when you see like the money's being made by like Fortnite, it's like, all right, cute game mechanic, bro. Like, I have friends who waste their life on Call of Duty back in the day. It's the same people. It's not a good game. Call of Duty 7 is not a good game.
Do you play any games right now that you like in particular?
No. Occasionally I'll play I played Factorio and Slay the Spire, and these kind of like, thinking sort of games, but they're the exact same things that existed like, 10, 15 years ago. They're not, I have not seen innovations in the gaming space, and I'm very excited to.
What do you think of Facebook's Oculus Rift, their whole, push into this?
So sad. It's so sad. Okay. So I bought a Rift back in the day. I had a Rift back in the day. The Rift back in the day had this amazing, like, the games weren't even that good, but it had this amazing like setup experience. You like picked a floppy disk, you put it in the drive, you could play with these things. It like demoed all these amazing features of the Oculus Rift. I bought an Oculus Quest 2. Okay, the first thing it puts me in is incredibly lame cloud world where you have to like click through all these things. You're logging in with Facebook. And then it makes you watch this terrible safety video. And like, it was just the whole onboarding experience was atrocious. It was like this like gaming is for everyone kind of stuff, right? Like, look, I'm all for gaming is for everyone. But like, can you make it cool? Like, what everyone finds cool isn't. Nobody finds this cloud thing cool. Like, you know, the things that could have been done with that, the hardware is great. I have a friend who works at Oculus on hardware and the low-level stuff, and the Quest 2 is a beautiful piece of hardware. The inside-out tracking is great. There's so much potential there, but it is ruined by these, like you do not have the same sort of creative types in gaming anymore. You have this very, like you're making me watch, like, the lamest safety video ever. I have to go through this 20-minute onboarding before I can – oh, yeah. And then it comes up to the home screen, and there's, like – oh, I got to download a game. It's 6 gigabytes. I don't know what's good. Like, build a world, bro. Don't, like, you know. So, you know, I used it twice. The retention on VR is terrible. You know, it has so much potential. But I feel that Facebook is not the company to do it.
Interesting. Fascinating stuff. George, I want to thank you for chilling with us here for the past couple hours on a wide range of topics. Fun stuff, man.
Thanks. Cool. One more question for you, George. I wanted to ask real quick is, do you believe, like, philosophically speaking, do you believe in the singularity? And if so, like, what would be your estimate of that time frame?
Wait, it's already happened. Of course it is. Every day I'm like, wow. Well, so first off, it's already happening, and it kind of sucks more than I thought it would. But, like, you know, it is what it is.
Okay. So do you think, like, there'll be a point in 20 years where we kind of reach this end goal of the singularity, or 50 years or 100 years, where it's just, like, we sort of merge or go into some utopia or something?
Oh, no, I don't know about any of that. That sounds like if I was selling people on a cult, maybe I'd say that kind of stuff. No, I do think that the amount of so in like 2038, you're going to be able to buy a desktop and it's going to have the same compute power as a human. By like 2058, the amount of silicon flops in the world will surpass the amount of biological flops. And then we're no longer the dominant species on the planet. Like, I think that's going to happen, but I don't think there's ever going to be like a hard takeoff singularity where there's like the change, and like, it makes for good sci-fi, but I just don't really think it's going to happen. I think, you know, humans are the new horse. They're going to become kind of less and less employable and useful over time as computers are just kind of better at us than everything. And, you know, this includes me. And like, you know, I hope they're nice to me and let me retire in peace. Like, I'm cool with that. Like, you know.
But no, it's scary to think about. Yeah, it's scary to think about with my kids getting older and such. You know, it's going to be a crazy world by then.
It's going to be a crazy world, but it's never going to feel crazy to them. Mm-hmm. Right, like to the kids, it's always going to feel like, well, you know, obviously, right? And I think this is the amount of change in the human condition over years has been wild, and you know, we're pretty adaptive. We seem to do it right. It'll be the normal for them, whatever it is.
But it does seem to accelerate, right? I mean, at some point, that acceleration you're saying is not going to continue. It's not going to go straight up. It's just going to kind of level out, maybe, or something.
What axis are you talking about?
Like, just change, technological improvements, change, you know, like Moore's Law, computing, you know, all this stuff just seems to be accelerating.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I think in the last 10 years, we've actually seen a surprisingly little amount of technological change, right? Like 10 years ago, I could buy a decent smartphone. I could buy a Tesla Model S. I could buy like most of the stuff that's available now was also available 10 years ago, which was not true for the 10 years before that. True for the 10 years before that, right? So, like, no, we've hit kind of a lull with technology. Moore's Law continues. Or when you compare, like, when I think about what's changed my life in the last 10 years, it's been like, you know, really like nothing. But when you compare that to like when refrigerators came into homes or televisions or like some crazy stuff that happened in the 20th century, it's like, I don't know. I don't really see this accelerating. I do see Moore's Law is on an exponential, but in terms of actual impact, it seems approximately linear.
Okay. Thanks.
I love talking with you because, some of the stuff your angles are quite entertaining and fun. Like just even your comment of how this singularity has already happened, most people probably won't understand it. But
if you define a singularity as when we're all kind of networked into one big brain, it's like, yeah, that kind of happened.
You've previously talked about the possibility of living in simulation. It's possible that, you know, singularity has happened at a different, you know, place.
Yeah, the simulation people, I think people took the wrong stuff away from when I talked about that. I was just kind of talking about like, bro, like there's a whole world out there. Stop, you know, whatever the bullshit is you're thinking about, man. This is universe impacting. The decisions we make in the next 100 years can alter the course of the entire universe.
Yeah. Okay, so on the simulation, because I think it's a worthwhile, you know, thing to talk about, because you did bring it up. I actually do think a lot of people took it the wrong way in some ways, where they're like kind of like this deterministic kind of, oh, nothing matters anymore.
Ah,
that type of idea.
Everything matters.
We're just pawns, right? And nothing, we have no influence or control. And, you know, we'll never know.
Non-player characters.
Yeah, we'll never know. You know,
there's a lot of them out there. I've seen them. I've met them.
Yeah. Never know life beyond, you know, the simulation. But I think for me, it's like, I look at it more like, hey, you know, it's pretty obvious that pretty much everything we see is software. It's code. You know, code runs, you know, everything. I mean, this is one of the biggest revelations, in my opinion, in our lifetime, is going to be the revelation that everything in the world is code, you know, or is run by code, yeah. Right? From that kind of, you know, foundation, which a lot of people still don't agree with, but I think, you know, as time progresses, 10 or 20 years, it's just gonna be a matter of fact, you know, that code runs, you know, is a thing that is, you know, running our tree and, you know, running the atoms and everything in society, or the universe. And from that kind of, you know, foundation, it's like, okay, if everything is software or code, who wrote this code? You know, obviously it's like, it just didn't happen by Big Bang per se.
I don't know about that, but like, the everything is code today is the same way people in the 1950s said everything is physics. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just like we have this new paradigm for interpreting the world. Like physics was the best paradigm. This is what I mean about like the modernist era and the postmodernist era. Everything is code. Everything is statistical and probabilistic. And yeah, I mean, who wrote the code? Who built the universe? People have been asking this question forever. I mean, you know, I generally agree with the answer that they came to, which is God built the universe. And like, you know, maybe when you transcend, you meet God. And that sounds right. I don't know why people dismiss that so quickly, that like someone created the universe.
Yeah,
like,
I agree.
I think it's true. I think it's pretty obviously true, right? Like, I don't know. But, you know, I'm not like religion is used to you know, justify all these things. And that's where like you lost me. It's like, well, okay, there's a God, he created the universe. I don't know. That doesn't mean that you should like, you know, show up at my little building with some windows and like, you know, go like this.
Yeah. All right, George, I'm going to end the conversation here, but I'd love to, I love chatting on these topics. I think they're definitely impactful, important topics that people need to think about more just in general, just where the world's headed, you know, how things work. We'd love to chat with you again sometime in the future. And it's been an honor. How do people follow you? I know you have an Instagram account. I'll go ahead and link to that.
I do have an Instagram, yeah.
Yeah, I found your YouTube channel. Do you run the YouTube channel?
No, I don't run the YouTube channel. I don't run the YouTube channel. The guy has emailed me, and my basic rule is like, look, if you want to post my stuff on there, I'm cool with it for now. Do not edit it.
Got it.
Do not edit, right? Do not take out of context. Like I just DMCA'd and tore apart someone's channel who tried to post clips. Do not do that, right? Whole thing or nothing. So I don't run that. I do have an Instagram, but it's largely because, you know, you get that blue check mark, right? Instagram is the best dating app in the world, so.
And then you've got some hip hops or just like some songs, right?
Yeah,
heard some pretty good.
Saw
pretty
some
good
on your YouTube. I was impressed. That YouTube channel. So, and you're not on Twitter much, though, right?
Oh no! Twitter is pox successful. Right, like Instagram glorifies like beauty and like, you know, eating nice food, staying in nice places, and Twitter is like, you are a bitch. Ha 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 ha. It's perfectly in 140 characters, right? So
got it. Understood.
Yeah.
All right, George, take care. Have a great day. And cool. Wish you the best in everything that you're doing.
You too. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Thanks.